In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
We'll explore South Dakota's pillars of economic development. From SDPB, today is Monday, July 7th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Joe Santos and Bill Even are with us for a special Monday Macro. We'll talk about the boundaries of economic growth. Now, the state has low unemployment and high labor participation, which means there isn't a lot of room for growth in those areas. Meaningful economic growth centers on productivity. We'll talk about what that means, especially in areas the state prioritizes, such as advanced manufacturing and bioscience. Plus, what does it mean if we make invisible taxes visible? Wealth advisor Rick Kaler unpacks the tariff tax. That's coming a bit later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. With talk of tax cuts in Washington and the gubernatorial race heating up here at home, perhaps now is a good time for a refresher on economic growth. South Dakota has high labor participation and low unemployment. That leaves productivity as a main focus for future growth. Joe Santos is the director of the Ness School of Management and Economics at South Dakota State University. There, he also leads the Dykehouse Program in Money, Banking, and Regulation. Bill Even is the commissioner of the Governor's Office of Economic Development. The professor and the commissioner join me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studios in Sioux Falls for this edition of Monday Macro. So we've been talking a lot about open for business, open for opportunity, economic development. There are new political candidates talking about economic development. You and I are not talking about politics today. However, how important is the Office of Economic Development in your estimation, and what exactly does it do? Tell us a little bit about that before we get started on the Schooled blog post here.
Yeah, thanks, Lori. So the Governor's Office of Economic Development was established by Governor George Mikkelsen back in 1987. So we're coming up on nearly 40 years of those investments back into our state. Mm-hmm. And I think you look at the state's economy, and if you look at the state's population, and you look at how our state looks today versus it did in 1987, you can see that growth in a tangible fashion, both mm-hmm. in population, income, as well as in the businesses that are in our state. I often like to tell people, you know, our family farm in Humboldt, South Dakota was homesteaded in 1884, Dakota Territory. Mm-hmm. And it looks dramatically different today than it did in 1884 or 1924 or 1984. But the things that still stick with us here in South Dakota are our core values. And that's a lot what Governor Roden's been talking about is, you know, safe, strong, and free, and is open for opportunity. Yeah. If you maintain your core values over time, you'll make really good decisions on your economic development choices as well.
So have you lived here mostly your whole life?
Yes. I've had a few different roles that took me out of state for a while, but back in South Dakota here now.
All right. So how much has that farm changed since 1987?
It's changed dramatically. Yeah. And so we were in the hog business at that time, row crop and cattle. Today we are in the seed business as well as farm chemicals, agriculture equipment repair, and still in the cattle and row crop business. But the farm does look a lot different, and I think that's important. My son is now the fifth generation, and if you don't change and modernize and reinvest for the times, there wouldn't be an opportunity for him, his wife, and their three children.
Yeah. All right, Joe, we're going to talk about bounded optimism. And so I think of making the pie bigger, and you talk about this in the beginning in this blog, which is it's not always easy to allocate wealth, for example, mm-hmm. but it's easier if there's more to go around. Help us get started here with that.
Right.
Concept.
So that's right. So when we think about economic growth, we often measure it a specific way, and often that way has to do with income of some form. And we focus on economic growth, and so we focus on income, as you say, from the perspective of growth, growing the amount of income available to, say, households, individuals. And when we do this, we are well aware of the fact that there's the production of economic activity, but then there's also the distribution of economic activity. And I start the blog by, you know, admitting this, that look, the distribution question is a difficult one. Who gets the spoils, as it were, is a difficult question to answer, but it's going to be easier if we have more of the spoils. And right. So in the blog, in this discussion, I focus on growing, as you say, the pie, growing, let's say, personal income per capita, understanding fully that that's an average measure. It, in principle, doesn't represent any individual's income. It's an average, and that there's a distribution around that average. But again, the question of distribution is a difficult one. It'll be an easier one to answer if we have more stuff to distribute than less stuff. And so economists often focus on growing the pie, growing, let's say, some average measure of economic activity, like, let's say, personal income per capita. Again, we know full well there's a distribution question waiting for us after we deal with the production question. But let's first deal with the production question, which is typically our approach.
Yeah. Commissioner, do you have economic goals? Like, what? How much growth is enough growth? How much growth is, you know, because we're going to talk about these boundaries around what we can influence and what we can't. How does this work in your world?
Yeah, so the free enterprise system and capitalism will determine that rate of growth, and those things are balanced just across the macroeconomy, as Professor Santos is talking about. We've got six different target areas that we look at here with the state of South Dakota on areas that we feel we have a competitive advantage. And these are the areas that we're really specifically looking at, whether it's recruiting businesses or looking for business retention or expansion. Those areas are in advanced manufacturing, biosciences, cybersecurity, livestock development, think cattle, hogs, dairy in that sense, value-added agriculture, so the processing side of the equation, what comes off the farm, and then precision agriculture to make sure that we're doing things very well and sophisticated into the future. So those areas are what we target, but we're open for business for any type of business opportunity in South Dakota, be it expansion or people that want to come into our state.
Advanced manufacturing, what's that mean?
So if you think about making components, advanced machining, and so forth, mm-hmm. Most people don't know there's a company here in Sioux Falls that's making advanced equipment for the U.S. Navy. There's a lot of businesses in South Dakota that may not have the quote-unquote high brand name recognition.
Sure.
We've got a lot of businesses here that are making the subcomponents that are critically important. So we've got a beachhead in some of these areas, which includes the defense industry.
All right. So, Joe, let's talk a little bit about the boundaries that you're talking about when it comes to personal income per capita.
Yeah. So if we take, let's say, personal income per capita as a measure of economic activity, and so as a measure of economic growth, we can think of growing personal income per capita. We can decompose it. We can think of this measure as really the the product of other smaller measures and things like, for example, the labor force participation rate. So how many people in the population are actually participating in the labor force, mostly employed, but also unemployed and looking for work, let's say. We can think about the employment rate. All those people who are in the labor force, how many of them are working? So you can think of the employment rate as one minus, say, the unemployment rate.
Help me understand the difference between the employment rate and labor
participation. So labor force participation rate is just saying, look, we've got this population of individuals who, let's say, are in South Dakota. What percentage of that population is either working or actively looking for work? Okay. The employment rate then is, okay, of that labor force working or looking for work, how many are working? So let's think of numbers here. The labor force participation rate for, let's say, South Dakota is something like 68%. 68% of the population in the state is either working, most of them are working, or they're actively looking for work. And then of those people, as I say, most of them are working. The employment rate's about 98%. So 2% unemployment rate, 98% employment rate.
So the gap between there is made up of whom?
So it's a very small gap for South Dakota, 2%. These are these people, these individuals.
No, I mean between the 68% and the 98%.
Oh, sure. So the 68% is relatively low compared to, say, the 98% employment rate, because the 68% is saying, look, of the population, some of them are 3 years old, some of them are 92 years old, some of them are just not interested in working, some of them are unable to because of other commitments they may have, and so on. So that's why we get this 68% number, which may sound low, but it's high relative to, say, the national average. We actually have a higher labor force participation rate in the state than we do in the nation. But the point of boundaries here that you brought up in your question is important. When we think of, say, the labor force participation rate, the point here is that whatever that number is, it is that number because of demographic forces, patterns of migration of individuals who are coming into the state, let's say, to join the labor force. These are very slow patterns in the economy. And it's not likely that we, or if I may say Bill or the Governor's Office of Economic Development, can do a whole lot to, say, change labor force participation rates or employment rates. They're bounded because, again, we are essentially our labor force participation rate is rather high now. And again, it's bounded because some of the folks in the population are 3 or 93, for example, or it's our employment rate is bounded because it's at 98% employment, 2% unemployment. It's not a lot we can do to raise that employment rate much higher. Mm-hmm. And so when we start to look at how to increase personal income per capita in the state, we see the labor force participate and say, okay, well, we get it, but we kind of want to move past that because we don't have a lot of policy instruments that can get that number much higher for long periods of time. We go to the employment rate, and we say, okay, that number's at 98%. There's not a lot we can do there to raise that much higher. And so what we're left focusing on is productivity.
Yeah.
Is
we also basically, can't make people work more hours.
It really can't do that, right? Because
largely
we have,
you're capped by
it's about 2,000 hours a year. And, and let's think about that as a policy instrument. Were we to increase that, that's not really anyone's conception of increasing the standard of living that is making people work 4,000 hours a year instead of 2,000 hours a year. So, yeah, we sort of take a pass on all of those. And that brings us to this idea of labor productivity. Mm-hmm. How do we get more economic activity out of each hour of work?
Yeah. Before we get to that, I do want to go back to participation a little bit, because you and I were talking before we started recording, and I brought up child care, elder care, participation because of other services, and that's a policy.
That's right.
Complication. So you could, in theory, increase participation a little bit if, I don't know if that would be the outcome, but
That's right. So there are folks who are, let's say, on the sideline.
Or caregiving. Yeah.
That's right. There are folks who are on the sideline right now who would participate in the labor force if not for other constraints. And so we could imagine policies that free them of those constraints and then allow them to enter the labor force. So there is a policy play there. It's critically important to think about. It's a very important question. I don't want to diminish it at all. But there are some one-time benefits there, enormous benefits that we should exploit if we could, I agree, but they are one-time. And so if we're looking for economic growth, a 2%, 3% increase in personal income per capita year after year after year, it's going to be things like growth in innovation, in the creation of knowledge, in developing skills in the workforce and so on that we can just continuously improve upon. Allowing individuals to enter the labor force, individuals who can't now because of constraints that are imposed on them, child care, for example, elder care, just examples. Of course, if we can do something there, we should. But analytically speaking, those would have one-time effects. To have growth effects, we really have to focus, in addition, on things like innovation, learning, knowledge creation, and so forth.
So, Bill, sometimes when I think of economic development or economic growth in South Dakota, I think of new businesses coming into South Dakota. But now that you say this list, I also am thinking of education and tech schools and colleges and programs that would feed the knowledge. So before we get too deep into labor productivity, what are some of the tenets of economic development or growth that you consider critical to your work?
Yeah, thank you. So the number one place you start, it doesn't matter if you're in sales, you want to make sure you've got your existing customer. You want to try to grow that customer, if you think about it through that lens. So if you think about economic development for South Dakota, one of the first places you look is you look at the businesses that are looking to expand or you're looking to retain. So if a business has a potential opportunity to move out of state, you want to start those conversations early and make sure you understand their issues. It could be a workforce availability issue. Those are things that then we can assist with on that front. But ideally, you're looking at a business that's expanding in South Dakota. So that's where you start. Mm-hmm. And then the icing on the cake certainly is then recruitment into the state. And those are bringing new businesses into the state that may have not been here before. So if you think of those things kind of sequentially, if you think about them as your customer, in this case, they're in the state, you want to start with the fact that what do we need to do to make sure that you're comfortable here and enjoy continuing to produce here? Mm-hmm. And then are you interested in expanding? How can we assist with that or help you think through that, including works with, say, like the Small Business Association administration? And or then also we do a lot of work externally with site selectors who there'll be companies around the United States that are looking for places to go to and grow. Mm-hmm. And we want to make sure that the communities in our state are ready to have those conversations with site selectors, for example.
So what are some of your boundaries? Workforce, we hear that all the time. If a company wants to move here, are there going to be enough people who will apply for that job? Mm-hmm. That strikes me as a boundary that you might be up against.
So when I travel across the state, and I've been back here about 7 weeks now working for Governor Roden, and going across the state, you hear similar issues tend to emerge. Number one is often related to infrastructure. Do you have natural gas in your community? Do you have rail in your community? Do you have adequate water supply for the processing? Do you have the roads and the bridges? Do you have the electrical power? That's rapidly becoming a thing again. And do you have fiber? Essentially, do you have your internet connectivity? Mm. Those are really predicates before any business is able to even operate. And then along with that comes workforce, comes housing, and comes what you just discussed, childcare, right? The ability to ensure that you've got childcare in that community as well. So those are common themes regardless of where you're at in a state, frankly, South Dakota or anywhere.
Yeah. All right. So let's get into productivity. Mm-hmm. Joe, how do you measure that?
Yeah, so what we're measuring is economic activity. So we can think of income, for example, divided by an hour of work, right? So that's the idea. And that number is, we can report that number. It'd be a dollar amount of income per hour of work. It's a big average. Mm-hmm. What we tend to focus on is the growth in that number. So you'll often hear economists refer to 2 or 3% growth in productivity than saying an hour of work in South Dakota generates $82. You know, that's a bit less meaningful for most folks. But the growth in that number is what we focus on. And, you know, to Bill's point, if there are workforce constraints, and we said there are labor force participation constraints, then the one thing we could do is for every one of those hours of work that we do have in the state or in the nation, we have that hour of work be more productive. So that's the reason for the focus on that. What drives it? Well, we think of this as basically physical capital. So the machinery, the equipment, the infrastructure that Bill just mentioned would drive productivity, equipping labor with machinery and equipment, for example. Human capital is another piece, though. Having the individuals who are performing during that hour of work have the skills necessary, the expertise, the training. So we say sometimes we deepen human capital as well. Mm-hmm. That's very important. But the most important is innovation, what I like to think of as the recipes. So we've, you know, got the same ingredients in some way, shape, or form. Question is, can we bring these ingredients together in new and innovative ways, have new and innovative recipes that lead to more output for each hour of work. And really, the fundamental input to coming up with those new recipes is knowledge. So this gets us to a very important point that's sort of fundamental driver of productivity, and the growth of productivity is the creation of knowledge. You got to come up with newer, better ways of doing things in order to continually grow output that each hour of labor input is responsible for.
And this is where I need some examples, because if of everything in the blog post, which people can find at school.blog.com, we'll put a link up on our website so you can get there quickly, is explain knowledge to me, which sounds like a dumb thing to say. Explain knowledge to me. But in what way are you using the word knowledge here?
Yeah.
Give me an example of how that's one of the keys.
Yeah. So really, not to be too sort of abstract about this, but it's all that we know about everything. Mm-hmm. And so all that we know about how to turn inputs into outputs. So there was a way that we understood to turn inputs into outputs in the 1930s when we were building an automobile. And there is since that time new knowledge about automobile production that allows us to build an automobile in very different and innovative ways today. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about the amount of automobiles that an hour of labor produces today relative to the amount of automobiles that an hour of labor produced in 1936, there is an enormous difference. The difference is positive, and we would think of that difference as economic growth. So there's an enormous difference in the growth of automobile production per hour of work that has been driven, pardon the pun, driven by innovation, by knowledge creation. We know more now about automobile production than we did, say, then. And it's really that allows us to grow continuously through time. I mean, now there'll be more that we know about automobile production in, I don't know, 2055.
Sure.
And as a consequence of that, we will have more automobile production, or whatever the thing is that we get in and get around town in 2055. There'll be more of that per hour of work in 2055 than there is now. And again, that leap will be what we think of as economic growth. But notice, in none of this, as I said, we'll get 99% of the labor force to be employed instead of 98.
Right.
Or we'll get 72% of the population in the labor force instead of 68% of the population. Those aren't the long-term sort of strategies. It all centers around productivity, which centers around knowledge creation.
So it seems like precision ag would be a really good example, too. Give me an example of how precision ag is addressing that knowledge/productivity equation.
Yeah, I think if you sum this up in how I would think about it, the old classic saying, right, if you build a better mousetrap, the world will beat a path to your door. And I think mm-hmm. that's what you're talking about. Capitalism and the American approach to things around free enterprise is really driven by competition. And that competition hones us in those spaces so that you build those new components. So if you look at precision agriculture, South Dakota State University has had some investments in that space. Pretty significant investments and endowments in that space from the industry. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking with John Deere or Raven Industries or someone else. I look at the farm equipment that we operate today on our farm at Humboldt. The level of sophistication in there is mind-boggling. Mm-hmm. You may think your car has a lot of switches and in a touchscreen interface. You ain't seen nothing yet until you get inside some of the equipment that's out there on the landscape. I often joke that we had self-driving tractors 15 years ago, so long before Elon Musk was in this game, we in agriculture were doing that. And the ability to do variable rate seeding, variable rate fertility, mm-hmm. change the equipment as it's running across the field. You're literally monitoring as an operator in this equipment nowadays with that level of sophistication. Our productivity in our farm, it used to be if we had 100 bushel an acre corn back in the 80s, dry land corn, it was like, okay, that's a pretty good yield. Yeah. And nowadays, between the technology and the seed and the technology we're applying across that landscape, you know, you easily shoot 200 bushel an acre if you get some rain. That is an example of productivity in agriculture that we live and die by. Those same things apply whether you're across advanced manufacturing as well.
Okay. All right. So what are some of the ways, because when you say, you know, free market and capitalism, I think this blog is a really great description of capitalism as well, as you read through it, and how free is free, mm-hmm. because you're also making an argument here that the incentives and partnerships, and those are also important. Free doesn't necessarily mean entirely hands off.
That's right.
It doesn't mean no regulation.
It doesn't mean no regulation. It also doesn't mean no support for free enterprise. To pick up on what Bill said, and with which I agree entirely, free enterprise capitalism through the magic of competition drives innovation, inspires firms to enhance productivity in order to compete in that free enterprise environment. But if we think about this for a second, if the sort of the fundamental source of innovation and productivity growth is knowledge, we run into an interesting rub. Knowledge is a public good in the sense that it is what we would say is non-rival. Unlike a shirt, which if you're wearing it, I'm not. Mm-hmm. If you know 2 + 2 = 4 and share with me that 2 + 2 = 4, you don't suddenly forget that 2 + 2 = 4, right? Yep. And so the production of knowledge and the distribution of knowledge, if done entirely in a competitive environment, leads to a sort of race to the bottom in terms of price competition, where we price at marginal cost, and the marginal cost of telling me that 2 + 2 = 4 is 0. And so in a competitive environment, the price of supplying, distributing knowledge goes to 0, which means no one in their right mind in the private sector will go into the production of knowledge for profit without the support of the public sector. And mm-hmm. so this is why we often okay. will subsidize the production of basic scientific knowledge, for example, or simply assist the private sector in workforce development, or, and I don't mean this to be patronizing, but many of the wonderful things that the Governor's Office of Economic Development does mm-hmm. is centered around this fundamental principle of knowledge and its creation. And the insufficient amount of it that would be created if left exclusively to the private sector. In plainer English, there are positive externalities, there are network effects, there are benefits to the production of knowledge that the investor in knowledge creation is not going to reap alone. It's going mm-hmm. to be shared. And so that return, the social return, exceeds the private return. And so society does well to invest, support knowledge in a free enterprise system.
That's Joe Santos, director of the Ness School of Management and Economics at South Dakota State University, and Bill Even, the commissioner of the Governor's Office of Economic Development. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Tax cuts are politically popular, but what constitutes a tax can be a bit more slippery. Imagine your receipt from the hardware store, for example, including a line item for tariffs. Rick Kaler is a financial therapist. He's a wealth advisor and founder of the Kaler Financial Group in Rapid City. One of his recent columns takes a deeper look at the invisible tariff tax.
And I'll acknowledge right up front, there's so much emotionality around this, so many difficult feelings, because we're in a really, for me, unprecedented time where what are accepted as facts in my profession and industry are being not even questioned, just denied mm-hmm. as facts. And this makes it so hard. I've told people that I've probably never written more politically in my life than I have. And it's not because I'm changing what I write about. I write about economics and how they affect the individual and the relationship of emotions and money. That has just been taken to a place I never thought possible. So with that disclaimer, I really, as you know, Lori, work very hard at the media that I consume, making sure that I have facts. I fact check everything I write. I fact check everything I read. So I really put an effort into boiling all this down to what are the facts. So with that long disclaimer, tariffs are taxes. And they're taxes that are put on by a country on goods coming into the country. So they're nothing new. 100 years ago, maybe 150 years ago, we as the U.S. on, I think it was 49% of our national revenue coming from tariffs. So they probably hit their peak in the 1930s and were a contributing cause to the depression. But they are invisible taxes. They are paid by the people buying the goods in the country that levied the tariff. And they're paid by the importer. So when Chinese goods hit the U.S., there's a tariff, which is a tax, which you can frame it as a sales tax. It's very similar to a sales tax, or if you're familiar with the European system, a VAT tax. And so it's added to the price of that commodity and paid by that importer.
So if I import widgets and each widget is going to have a 34% tariff, then my price for the widgets goes up a lot. And then if I'm going to sell that widget, I need to turn around and somehow create a profit margin that my shareholders, or if I'm a small business owner, that I can somehow justify the profit margin. So at the end of the day, it's the person who buys the widget who is probably impacted. Do I understand that correctly?
Yeah, and here's where it gets a little murky. The 34% tax is a given. So let's just use $100. It's a $34 tax.
Okay.
Somebody's got to absorb it. I can think of three options. The first option is you add it on. And especially if you're in a very low profit margin, I know of a person in Florida that's an importer of bikes. There's just very little margin for him to maneuver. The second option is the importer, retail, the final retailer, or everybody in between absorbs it. They pay it. Mm-hmm. So they cut their profit margin. The third option is that the country, the manufacturer in the country that is sending the goods to us actually reduces their price.
Right.
Says, okay, we'll help you out. We'll absorb some of it. So you've got three places, three possible places that can pay this tax.
And then the fourth, now, I want to add a fourth thing, which is I could get my widgets from someone who makes them in America.
Yes. So you could, and that's, thank you for bringing that out. That is a buying decision on the part of the consumer. If it goes up 34%, like I have written about my toilet that went up from $320
right. to yeah.
$395, I can say, you know what? I think I'll buy an American standard and not a foreign one, which is part of the motivation, which is
that's the political
why you
yeah.
put a tariff on.
Yeah, that's
right?
the political message anyway. And I would like to point out, I have no idea if American standards or toilets are made in America anymore. So,
Lori, you're very astute.
The brand would indicate that. I do not have time to pause our
parts of those American toilets come from some other place,
right?
Which exacerbates the complexity
right.
of all of it. So you've got a lot of moving parts in the in these tariffs. Somebody is going to pay them, or mm-hmm. somebody's, regardless of how they get paid, they are a tax. And when you start shrinking profit margins and or increasing the price of goods, it has an economic impact.
Right. So one of the things we learned during the pandemic with supply chain disruption was there were certain things that we thought, I always remember the Italian Q-tips, that people were like, how can it be possible that America doesn't make Q-tips anymore? And so then the idea was, if we can't get something, or if there's a disruption, or if there's a tariff, we should be more self-sufficient. But as I read your column, and as I talk to other economists, this is just not the most efficient and cost-effective way to do business, is to have a we're not going to import anything kind of mentality.
Yeah. Yeah, we have worked toward open borders as far as trade goes for decades. That has been the goal, is to not have any tariffs and have open trade. And and price things competitively, let the free markets work. And I as you were talking about the Q-tips, the one thing that comes to mind for me are iPhones, and how the iPhone, according to the data that I have read, if it was manufactured in the U.S. and this is an iPhone that costs $999, it would cost $3,500 to manufacture it in the U.S. That's why we have become competitive in the global market. We can't grow coffee here. We can't grow chocolate here. Free trade has raised our standard of living greatly and has benefited the whole world because it's efficient. Mm-hmm. You've got economies playing to their strengths rather than their weaknesses. So I think what we're learning very slowly, and I don't think the lesson is over, is what a delicate balance this is, what a benefit that free trade has been. And this is a massive aircraft carrier of free trade that we're trying to turn back to an isolationist economy. That is, we will become self-sufficient. If we don't make it, we don't want it. And that is a huge reversal in things. Now, I don't know that that's the stated intent. I don't even know. I think some of the intentions here are very good, because when you talk about national security and talk about jobs, but we know that protectionism actually ends up costing jobs and hurting the economy. And we just cannot turn this aircraft carrier to become self-sufficient and producing everything that we need to produce this side of 5 to 10 years. And are the American people willing to pay $3,500 for an iPhone?
Are the American people willing to completely rethink their standard of living as adjustments are made to the global economy and America's participation in it?
Exactly. Exactly.
I mean, I remember talking to somebody who's from Norway, and we're having a conversation about what's on the shelves, and this was some years ago, and they were like, you'd be so bored because there's two kinds of soap. And Americans are used to seeing 42 kinds of soap and choosing from them. Do we need 42 kinds of soap? You know, you could argue not. However, if there's two kinds and you don't like those two kinds, Americans get kind of cranky because we are used to a standard of living that gives us 42 choices of soap.
And that's precisely the argument that the president made, that you don't need to choose from 20 dolls.
Yeah.
You need to choose from two. So it's very clear
which
that
which works great if you're a parent in a store telling your child to pick from these
yeah,
two
choosing
dolls.
Choosing from two is a lot easier than 20.
But if it's the entire America picking the two dolls that the president tells us we can buy, people don't like that.
And that is so true. And the intentions of wanting to level the playing field, a lot of the stated intentions are very good. At the surface, it's just the underlying implementation and the tactical details of this are incredibly complex. And I have a column coming out that you haven't read, where I looked at this, how unlevel were the playing fields? What I found kind of astounded me, and I'm going to talk off the top of my head, but it was like the U.S. had tariffs of 1.5% on the average, and other countries had 3% tariffs, maybe as high as 4.5%. Mm. So if you do the math, I think it was Europe that had, say, around 3.5% or 3%. Their tariffs were twice as high as ours. So it was not a level playing field. Mm. And there's been talk of that for decades,
right?
That
yeah.
China has charged us higher tariffs than we've charged them. So this is not an argument against a level playing field, but look at the difference we're talking about in tariffs. We're not talking in 1 and 2% anymore.
Right.
We're talking in 10 and 20 and 30 and 150%, which are devastating. This is why I believe in the past, there wasn't a lot done on the equaling the playing field. It was recognized that, yes, China's charging us, say, 1.5% more. But it wasn't nobody's hair was on fire.
Mm-hmm. Here's one thing that I think is interesting in your writing as well, which is what if question. What if on your receipt for the objects that you're buying, you could have a breakdown of some kind so you would understand and people would be more engaged again and again with saying that's the tariff. But the point of a tariff is also that it's not necessarily on the label.
It is not on the label. It's a stealth tax. Quite frankly, if you want to be a little bit conspiracy theory, you could argue governments love stealth taxes. Because the more people are aware of taxes, that's knowledge.
Right.
And that's, oh, wow, I didn't know that. And knowledge is so important. We've talked a lot about that. The most important thing first is dealing with the emotions, the emotional blocks, what's yeah. going on within, so that we can actually receive the knowledge.
Yeah.
The knowledge is important. And it's really important to make informed decisions as a consumer, because so many of our decisions are not informed. We don't check in with ourselves. We're not asking ourselves the questions. Is buying this in alignment with my values, so that you can make those important buying decisions? And understanding what I'm paying in tax is important. It's so important with emotional transparency and knowing where I am, and then external transparency
right.
is also critically important. And I think in this day and age, it's critically important to have from our government. It's something that mm-hmm. almost every candidate runs on. They say they're going to have the most transparent administration ever. It almost never happens. It's tariff issue is not going to go away. And I'd like to say something too, Lori, a little bit in defense of it. When you're looking at the inflation numbers coming out, inflation's ticked up a little bit, but it hasn't ticked up a whole lot. I wish I had written this source down. I saw a pricing article on pricing 50 items. And of those 50 items, something like half of them had not changed in price. And the other half, it had changes, and I think the biggest one was 15%. Now, that's being used as somewhat of evidence that these tariffs aren't going to matter. But we are just at the edge of this process of mm-hmm. discovering what it means of the disruptions. And I have read that reversing it is not going to be flipping a switch,
yeah.
even if tomorrow we go back to the old system. But we have also destroyed credibility. You know, if you travel internationally, you find that out very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real situation. And I also wrote, you know, our dollar's at a 3-year low. It's down around 10%. Well, that's a stealth tax because now that $100 item mm-hmm. is going to cost $110. In U.S. currency. And that's one that people hardly ever think about. And it's not evident, really, unless you travel. You say, wow, when I was here last time, that was $100. It's $110 today. What happened? And they'll say, well, we didn't raise the prices. I remember I had this lesson 35 years ago in Ireland. I'm like, you guys have raised your hotel prices. I can't believe how expensive. And they're like, we haven't raised anything. Your dollar went down. I did a interview with a very large cable news network yesterday. And they want to know how my clients are reacting to all this. Do you
yeah.
have clients coming in concerned about purchases and putting off this and holding on retirement and doing things? And I said, yes, about half my clients are very concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And the other half of my clients are very happy. And it was really hard for the reporter to grasp And I said, you know, my clientele is very broad based. And so the worldview is so important here. And it's so important to try and understand where both camps are coming from, because we have one camp of hope saying, yeah, it's a little tough right now. You know, business owners especially are being hit. But this is good. This is good. I trust what's happening. I trust the administration. They have a plan. They know what's going on. We're going to have to suffer for a little while. And then the other view is, OMG, this is terrible. I want a golden visa. I had never heard of what a golden visa was until the last year, which is a way to get a passport out of the U.S. I have clients concerned about having survival food and exit plans in buying silver and gold. So the spectrum is huge. I've never seen this type of dividing concerns in my financial career. And everybody is to be respected, and everybody is to be dealt with in a non-judgmental manner. But the worldviews are extreme. It's bringing it down to, and I kept coming back to in this interview, it comes down to the individual. Mm-hmm. And I said, the first thing you've got to address is, are the emotions, the difficult emotions that are going on.
Yeah.
The why, the fear, the anxiety, perhaps some denial. And then look at what makes sense for you. And I told him, for example, if somebody wants to sell out, my first statement is, we can do that. We can have you completely out tomorrow, which takes away, we've talked about this in the past, it takes away the resistance.
Right.
Because they're expecting me to go, like, I've read all your columns.
Yeah.
And it gives us a chance to have a thoughtful, a more present conversation about, okay, what's the world going to look like for you? And what's that mean? And we can come to a conclusion where, okay, maybe we don't sell out. Maybe we reduce their equities from 60% to 50%, or something that helps with the anxiety, helps them sleep at night, and helps them honor their values. So it comes down to a very personal decision. And right now, striking a balance is so important.
Yeah.
Being in that middle ground is so important. I have written extensively on don't let your politics guide your investment decisions, and be balanced in your media consumption.
Yeah.
Which is so important today.
Yeah.
And I have clients that are loath to turn on CNN and loath to turn on Fox. Well, you actually don't need to do either, because there are sources out there.
I was going to say, yeah.
And there's something out there. We've talked about this before. It's called Ad Fontes. They are a bias rating agency. And you can get on that and look at kind of what's in the middle and pick some sources that can provide both sides. So getting tied into what's going on within us, what's going on in our past, is at the very center of being able to accept information and be present and make conscious choices.
That's Rick Kaler. He's a wealth advisor and an international leader of financial therapy. He's founder of the Kaler Financial Group in Rapid City. You can find his blog posts and more at kalerfinancial.com, or go to SDPB's In the Moment online and search for Rick Kaler. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.